Hello and welcome to the award-winning Canine Hooper's World podcast. Everyone's invited. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of season 4 of Canine Hooper's World, the podcast. Now, I'm back over in the States for this episode, and I am very excited to be speaking to Kelly. Kelly, how are you?
Hello. Hi. I'm pretty good today. Thank you for having me. I think it's evening or late afternoon where you are, and I'm first thing in the morning, so.
Yeah, we've got a bit of a time difference, but we've made it work. And thank you so much for fitting me into your busy, busy schedule, because I know you've got lots going on and trials and teaching and all the other stuff. So for people that don't know you, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I am Kelly Dunbar, and I'm a dog trainer. That's, you know, I've been a dog trainer for a very long time now, decades, let's leave it at that. And I have over the years worked primarily in companion dog training and or shelter dog training. Mm-hmm. A shelter dog program that I designed about 20 years ago that brought enrichment to shelters, but via training. We're not just talking, you know, bring them toys and chews and such. It was at the time innovative, and honestly, sometimes I still think it is, in the sense that not enough shelters really are doing, I think, enough behaviorally to help the animals in their care. So an animal shelter program, a dog trainer, problem solver, mentor to dog trainers. I have been around the block a few times. So mm-hmm. Now I'm helping bring up new generations and fill in gaps in their education as well. Yep. And in my free time, because I don't get enough dogs in my life, I do more dog stuff.
Because what else do dog trainers do, right?
I mean, you know, what you say exactly. So I have some sport dogs and working dogs, and I do I play in French Ring primarily. Have never competed in Mondio, but have dabbled in Mondio in training for sure, because I like cross training. And it may do someday, may switch up and add that. And have not done IGP, used to not be interesting to me, and now kind of is. Maybe that's something we could talk about later in this mm-hmm. in this
chat. Let's start straight off, because I know there's going to be a lot of listeners, and to be honest, if I hadn't done a little bit of homework, what is French Ring? Because there seems to be lots of different kind of more protection-based sports, and it can be a bit tricky to keep up with all of them, because the days of there just being Schutzhund have gone, right?
Well, I mean, to be fair, the French people have been doing French Ring for a very long time, probably as long as the Germans have been doing Schutzhund. It never took off in other areas. I don't know why. I have some theories, but and primarily just, you know, well, I don't know why. So French Ring, you know, and a lot of the European working dog people over the years, you know, everybody had a working trial, right? And you have your working trials for your collies and farm dogs, and then there's gun dog work, and there's, you know, there's herding trials, and then there's protection trials for dogs that are doing the work of protection and police work and all that sort of stuff. So which, of course, the police have their own trials too, and the military have their own trials. So it's the French version, you know, and it definitely predates Mondio. Mondio is a very new sport, and the, you know, Mondio is world, right? Mondio was an attempt to bring together aspects of all the various unique to each country or region, you know, the different sports, yeah. And then so that people could compete together. And that was, I believe, the idea of Mondio when it started. But French Ring is just the French version. And it's, they all have their differences. You know, they all have their areas of emphasis, you know, from IGP, Schutzhund, to Mondio, to French Ring, to Belgian Ring, which really is, I think, the primary, the initial ring sport is Belgian Ring.
Okay.
It was brought to us by the Belgians.
And, I mean, that would make sense with the amount of
right. Hello, right. the Belgian breeds. So, and that's also, you know, that's also very unique to Belgium. Now, with the French Ring, they did bring it to North America. I don't think that it has spread out in Europe beyond France very much. But in mm-hmm. North America, the sports that we primarily play are IGP, which was probably the first sport that was brought here, and then French ring, and Belgian ring is not here at all, and then Mondio when it developed. You know, I don't know who developed Mondio ring or where it started, but those are the three that we have here. And in North America, it is we have Canada and the U.S. and Mexico that all do French ring. So
cool. So there's plenty of places that you can kind of go to trials, compete, and stuff like that.
Well, yes, plenty, plenty. You know, I think there's maybe 11 clubs. In the U.S. and the U.S. is a very large place, so you end up driving quite a distance to get to different events. Not like in France, where you know stone's throw, you can go to competitions every weekend. You know,
yeah.
And clubs, and you know, you can drive to three clubs within your region. Here, almost, and this is true of Mondio and actually IGP as well. People drive 2 to 5 hours one way to go to club. You know, we're not even talking competitions.
Yeah. I think as well, like being in the little island of Britain and then being in England, it always makes me laugh when people are like, oh my God, oh, it's quite far. It's like, oh, it's over an hour's drive. And I'm like, yeah.
Nothing.
Because we have no concept over here. Like, I mean, last summer I was traveling like 3-4 hours, like at least once a month to go and compete because that's where a show was. It was 4 hours yep. away. And if I got stuck in traffic, it was 5 hours away, you know?
Yep.
You just do it for the sport you love.
Yeah, the concept of time and travel is interesting for dog trainers. And I've noticed that in the UK when I'm there or when I've presented there in the past. People don't want to drive beyond an hour. It seems like a journey, I think. But
yeah.
Here in the big, wide open US, we literally go coast to coast sometimes for these things. And it's, you know, I had once somebody in a European decoy say, you American trainers are so lazy. I took offense to that because I'm thinking, how are we lazy? You know, because we were slow, you know, because maybe our dogs were not at a certain level at a certain age or whatever it may be. And I'm thinking, you're crazy. Like, you know, the effort that we have to put in to even just make this happen, to mm-hmm. see a decoy, you have no idea. We don't have people down the street. We don't have subsidized clubs, you know, government subsidized clubs. We don't have any of that. So putting together a club, getting enough people, making sure that the stars align with the having the right dog, the right time, the access to a club, access to a decoy, you know, is quite a challenge. I mean, the sports alone in and of themselves are so challenging, but then the practice of a sport is also already challenging because of the amount of effort and time and thought that you have to put into it. And then you add just the logistics and we're not lazy. We're crazy. We're a bit obsessed and mental, really.
Yeah. You know? So I feel like the protection sports I just want to get your sort of feel on it, because protection sports do get a bad reputation of, you know, yes, there are trainers that use tools that we will not use in our training. And I feel like it's a real shame because there are so many elements. Like, people always focus on the bite side of it and the bit where people are kind of using shocks and prongs to, you know, agitate the bite and stuff. And it's like, but there is so much more to these sports than just that one element.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the perception of the average person and, or I'd say a large portion of the non-competitive competitive dog training industry is mm-hmm. really misguided, generally speaking. Obviously, that's not everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really is. And you know, as I mentioned early on, it is a working trial, which is a breed test, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a character test for the animals that are bred to do the work that they're bred to do. Mm-hmm. And so therefore it is no different than having a collie doing a working trial, and they, you know, and they're chasing eye stalking. I mean, they're not biting, hopefully they won't get very far in their sport of choice or their work of choice if they're biting. Yeah. But for this, you know, the dogs are meant to be doing these things. And it is so much more than biting. I mean, one could argue that allowing a dog to do the thing that it's genetically built to express is the kindest thing you can do for the dog. Mm-hmm. And then putting that under stimulus control and having this be a part of your relationship with your dog is really, I mean, to me, it's a beautiful thing. That's why I do it. You know, I mean, it's, and if I had, I do have terriers. So to say, if I had terriers, I would do other things. I do other things. You know, I mean, you know, you do what the dog is bred to do. If you really honor what they are, and if you purposefully got a breed, you know, there's a real disconnect with people, right? At least in the U.S. I don't know if it's the same in the U.K. or in Europe, where people admire this, and even it's even gotten worse now with like TikTok and Instagram. People are like, wow, look at that cool dog doing that cool thing. Oh my gosh, they're impressive. And, you know, and then they, I want one. And
like, yes, we have that problem here.
Yeah. Do you really want one? Like, did you see what that dog just did? Like, imagine that in your living room. Imagine that when you're at the park, you know, with the kids all around. I mean, unless you, it's strange to me that people think they can get a highly specialized breed that hasn't really, although this is changing, hasn't really been, I would say watered down, but, you know, hasn't really been diversified. Like, they're still very specialized. There aren't a lot of pet Malinois around, for instance. I mean, there are some that are good in the house and some that have lower, you know, drives or are easier going, but it's still pretty much a very intense working breed. Whereas like you can get a lab that will sit on your couch and doesn't have to have, you know, gun dog drive or for instance. To think that you're going to get that and then not have to do something with them or be irritated that they do the things that they do is so strange to me, or to just deny them. You know, and to think it doesn't have to be that way. So to me, it's allowing them to express who they are. And it is in a controlled environment. Biting is sometimes about aggression for sure, but it's also sometimes about, some people would say there's a lot of prey in there and they just have the grab and sometimes the shake, which is not really prized in these sports. You know, that's okay because if you play tug with your dog and you're comfortable playing tug with your dog, you're already doing the thing.
Yes.
You know, and it's not that different. And again, the controls are a big part of it. Being a teammate with your dog, having the dog do the thing that they love to do, but with you and through you, is it's high level control, and it takes the relationship to an entirely different level.
Yeah. I was having this conversation the other day that I feel that my relationship with the girls was, you know, they were my baby girls and I love them to pieces, but my relationship with Dodge is different because we do a sport together and we do it competitively, and it is different.
It's your teammate. Imagine people who work with police dogs and such have a similar vibe, you know, or if you've got detection dogs that are out working, like you are a team, in my view anyway. I don't know that everybody sees it that way, but I think most of the people that I know that I train with and that are succeeding at high levels, you know, this is your teammate. This isn't a tool.
Yeah.
This isn't, you know, so it does. It takes things to another level. They appreciate it. And that doesn't have to be bike sports. That can be scent work. That can be detection. That can be herding. That can be, you know, agility, you know, just allowing them to do the doggy things because we've specialized them, to do things. And then so many of them now are denied the very thing that makes them who they are. So,
I think the thing that's worrying, like we see it over in the UK, and I'm assuming that you guys see it over in the States, is when people get these drivey dogs, they get these herding. And when I say herds, I mean the shepherds. So like your Dutch, your Belgium, your Germans. And then they decide they're going to do bite work, but it just is basically about getting the dog to be a protection dog, and kind of you're like, okay, but now you're going to take that into the world and let it off in the park with everyone else? Because obviously we don't have leash laws in parks here. So someone can train their dog that biting the humans is the fun thing, and then just let it off in a park with people. And I see it happen over here, and you're like, is that safe? Like, do we need to be a bit careful about what we're training dogs to do?
I guess it depends on how they're being trained. You know, it's amazing to me that there are no leash laws there.
People just go to the park and it's okay because the dogs are friendly.
But legally?
I wish people could see Kelly's face right now. Like, I'm sorry, what are you talking about?
I mean, it would be nice if, in a perfect world, there wouldn't be leash laws because they wouldn't be necessary, because everyone's dogs really are under control, and dogs do deserve the freedom to not roam into people's picnics and wreak havoc, you know, among the other park goers. But, you know, if I imagine that there must have been a point in time where this wasn't a problem, you know, for it to be the rule. But we don't really have so much of that. I mean, it can be unique to a specific park or municipality. But just because your dog can be off leash doesn't mean that they should be. Now, that said, depending on what you're teaching your dog, it should be okay for a well-trained sport dog to be off leash and under control, just like any other dog. Mm-hmm. We don't train them to just bite willy-nilly. Now, I think people who see something on TikTok might be doing that. You have no business training a dog to bite if you don't have guidance from a professional that has been doing this for a while. So there's that. But it's just because a dog bites in a sport environment does not mean that they are going to be a public nuisance or a danger whatsoever. I would again argue perhaps the opposite. You know, the sports are very contextual.
Yes.
You know, and dogs are very good at reading context. They are also, again, usually trained more frequently and better than the average person's dog, you know. So they're less of a menace than a dog that's like a fear biter or running around, or a dog that's been imported from, you know, another region or country that is probably half feral and is going to be off leash and chasing people or biting or nipping people in the butt, you know. So it's not really a danger if it's done correctly, but that's true of anything, you know. I mean, you know, it's if you have a working collie and there's children playing a game of football at the park, like, that could be a danger. But are the collies under control, or do they understand that the context is off, or they know that children aren't sheep, or whatever it may be? You know, it's to me silly to throw out the baby with the bathwater. And it also really kind of irritates me because it takes the responsibility off of good training and handling. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not the sport or the activity that's the problem. It's people that aren't doing training or aren't seeking professional advice are doing training poorly that are the problem. And I don't think we should get rid of an entire very enriching sport, whatever it is, you know, because you know, some bad apples. I think education is the key. Opportunity is the key. You know, getting people out there to learn more about the various sports and to have a go or just understand, you know, because if you think about it, like in the UK, sheepdogs are a big thing, right? You've got a lot of sheep and a lot of livestock, it seems to me anyway. And people, and it's a tradition, right? I mean, it's traditionally there are a ton of collies and people just kind of accept that, right? And it's kind of just normal because they're sheepdogs and they do their sheep thing. I mean, do people go around saying that border collies shouldn't be in the park? You know?
I mean, to be fair, some of the border collies I have seen in the park probably shouldn't be, but...
Well, yes, that's always going to be the case.
You know, when you gave the example of like collies herding children, I was like, I have seen this happen. You're like, you understand what your dog is practicing right now, because this is getting on the verge of like not a game anymore. And
But this goes back to, you know, to, you know, if you have a dog that has certain drives, your job is to find a way for them to express that and to put that on some kind of, stimulus control, you know, like train your dog, basically train your dog. Train your dog and provide appropriate outlets utilizing their natural abilities. Right. So, and it goes back to saying, who has these dogs that, why did you get the dog that you have? You know, it because it's pretty, because it was impressive, and you want to, you know, they're not to showboat. You know, I mean, these are living creatures with generations upon generations of drives and needs that must be expressed and will be expressed one way or another. You know, it's like, yeah. if you're not providing an outlet, they certainly will find their own if they've got the drive and the genetics to do so.
Exactly that. Yeah, exactly that. I think we need to kind of honor what we bred the dogs for originally, and people, I just wish people would be a bit more mindful with the breeds they're getting, because it amazes me how many people don't do any breed research apart from, oh, that one looks the right size or has the right coat length, or, you know, of course we all have our preferences. We both like dogs that like the bitey things. I also like things with fat heads as well. Those are my kind of preferences. But, you know, when people get these dogs, and it's not even necessarily like first-time owners, I just wish that people just do a little bit more research into what is going into their dogs rather than just going, that one.
Yes. And, you know, this has been something that's annoyed me for my 30-year career. And we're still not making such great headway there. I think this is where social media can be used for good, though. And it's just a matter of people getting out there. This is another really important passion of mine right now is just getting trainers out there showing good training on social media. And let's not just talk it. Let's do it. Let's show it, because it's a video age. And people will be impressed by you if you're doing good training, and then they will look into good training. You know, I don't want it just to be extreme videos. You know, I don't want it to, I mean, that's impressive to some people, and maybe that can be a catch, but then show your work in general and normalize the little bits and the foundations and the pieces that go into things, that, you know, normalize that training isn't generally very explosive or exciting. It's fun. It's interesting. It's great, but it's not a 30-second clip. It's a 90-second clip. It's not a TV show. So, and I think there are a lot of ways we can improve our message as professionals to normalize training. And I would really just love to see it become general knowledge, I guess, that, yeah, you get a dog to do something and then you do the thing. I mean, our world is getting smaller and smaller for dogs. People are indoors so much more. Kids don't really even play outside. There are, at least here, way more, not you with your open off-leash areas. You know, dogs are restricted.
But to be fair, I don't go to those open off-leash areas because there's no control of the dogs in the open.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. So, but I mean, like, we don't even, like, I don't, but are they losing any access? Because here they're losing access. Like, to, I mean, even the, you know, you can't find places to take dogs anymore. Yeah. So, you know, the world is getting smaller for these dogs. And unfortunately, I'm not saying that I like that this is the way it is, but to my mind, it's more like, you know, we're going to have to start treating our dogs like animals in captivity. Mm-hmm. Yes, they are domesticated animals. Yes, they've been with us for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And yes, they're obviously adaptable, but they don't adapt as quickly as society is changing. And if you're going to have a dog in your home, especially if it's a dog that was bred for something rather than just lap sitting, and there are those dogs, you know, you're going to have to do something, and you're going to have to probably do it in some structured format, because running at the park amok isn't really even an option here very often, and can change where you are too. But
I actually deliberately go to a gardens that is dogs are allowed but on leash, which for me is perfect because then I know all the dogs are on leash and we can go for a lovely walk and it's cool. But then, yes, we need the other outlets. And that's where, for me, sport comes in, because that's the time where me and Dodge are working together. We're doing our thing and he is getting that off lead thing. And I know there'll be people that are like, oh, what? So he only gets to go off lead when he's training. And I'm like, but he's not a sort of dog that wants to go off lead and just do his own thing. He wants to be with me doing stuff together.
Yes.
That's the dynamic we have.
And that can be trained in, or it can be a certain personality or type of dog, right? So, you know, there are dogs that just do want to roam and sniff. And then there are dogs that literally will just stay by your side anyway.
Sorry, guys, we had a little quick break because Kelly's acquired a Frenchie that was just missing her a bit. So she's had to be in the room. That's fine. We had to go and rescue a Frenchie. That's cool.
Yes, she's needy. She's very needy. She didn't come with separation anxiety. I think she had I know this for a fact. She had a traumatic loss of her owner. And when I got her from that situation, she was very worried about, you know, I think it developed right then and there. You know, she was like, you're never out of my sight. This is, you know, it was a sad, tragic situation that she experienced directly. And so sometimes she does okay. We've come a long way, but we're not at home. And so she was upset.
So change of environment changes the behavior. We know this.
Yes, exactly. So maybe she didn't know where I was. Anyway, apologies for that.
No, that's fine. That's cool. So I just want to circle back a little bit to go back to the French ring, because obviously we covered the kind of biting bit a little bit. But I'm assuming there is an obedience section and then a scent tracking section?
A good question. There is no scent work in French ring.
Ooh.
so, yes.
What do you mean there's no scent work? What do you mean you don't have to train them to track all the little steps?
Well, okay, let me take that back. There's a tiny bit of scent work. There is at the highest, the higher levels, there are three retrieves, and one of them is an unseen retrieve and a discrimination exercise.
Okay.
So there's a tiny bit of that in there. But there's no tracking. There's the discrimination exercise is, it's just one time. It's not even as much as you do in Mondio. So no, it is obedience, agility, obedience and protection, and agility. It's what they call it, but you know, it's not, it's literally just jumps.
Okay.
And there's a hurdle and a broad jump and a palisado wall.
Right. Okay.
So, and at the easiest levels, the beginner levels, you don't do any jumps. And then you do one jump at your first level, your entry level, which is your brevet, mm-hmm. which is kind of a test. Can the dog do this? Does the dog have the training and the temperament to participate in our sport? You know, like they have the BH and the IGP and stuff. It's basically a mm-hmm. temperament test.
Yeah.
And courage test to a degree. There's a gun shot in that level as well. So, but there's no jumps and minimal obedience. There is obedience, but it's not a big routine. And then every level gets more challenging, obviously. And then you mm-hmm. by level two, you've got three jumps and two retrieves, and at level three of three retrieves, three jumps as well. So
okay.
Yeah.
So is the with the heel work, is it like a very tight, close, kind of flashy type heel work? Like you know what I mean by like head up.
Oh yeah,
heel,
yeah.
It's not stylized. Is it more of a relaxed kind of how a dog would move more? And I'm gonna use air quotes around this, but more naturally, because let's face it, the pretty fancy pony step is not natural.
No, I mean, it's dressage, right? You know, I mean, in IGP, there's kind of a dressage element to it. It's very stylized and very precise, and the points are different. So it's a good question. No, French ring is very, I'm going to use air quotes now, very practical. You know, it's meant to be, you know, you live in the French countryside and your dog is going to you know, protect your basket with bread and wine while you, you know, go off to pee in the woods.
Can we put any more stereotypes in that?
It's what I've envisioned, though, like, because there is literally a basket, like in Mondio, you there's an object protection, element where that, you know, that has an object. In France, it's literally always a picnic basket.
Hilarious. So I've now got an image of your dog like on a wheel of cheese, like pretending.
I mean, what's more precious than your cheese and wine? Honestly.
To be fair, I feel my chihuahua would nail the protecting the cheese element like perfectly. She would be there for all the cheese protection.
So you know, and then you're walking through the countryside or through the village to and then maybe there's somebody who looks a little sketch and your dog's gonna have to do a little defense. But it's meant to look natural. Some would say sometimes it looks a little flat, especially to an IGP kind of person. I don't think it has to look flat. Some of that is about how you train, I suppose, too. But it should look kind of chill, you know. Some people teach contact as their primary heel and just use it the whole time in the exercises. I don't particularly like that. I think that can get contact healing is great for defense work, right? Because the dog needs to keep their eye on the perp, quote unquote, you know, suspicious person. Mm-hmm. And that person is going to maybe move around you and they need to keep their eyes elsewhere. So therefore, contact with the handler is the way they know that they're with the handler and don't have to.
Is that a shoulder contact?
Doesn't have to be shoulder. It can be rib cage. Depends on how you want to train. When they're doing the defense, they're not looking at whether the dog is foraging or even separating, really. That really is more about, can they just stay with the owner within a meter, preferably making contact. While the person is trying, the decoy is the dog's foil in French ring. You know, you start with your full points and then you lose points based on your performance or based on if the decoy can take away points from your dog.
Right, okay.
So, you know, there might be some trickery there, you know, all within certain rules and trying to get the dog to bite them when they're far away, but then they can come back to you or come back to the basket. So it's not stylized. But it is very specific. There are a lot of handler rules in French ring. Mm-hmm. you can lose a lot of points that way. I think it's a wonderful exercise for trainers because you don't get away with anything. You've got to be clear and consistent I've lost an entire 30-point exercise by missing out one word and changing my cue.
That's very strict.
Yes, it is.
I'm sat here going, this sounds interesting. And now I'm like, I don't think my brain could.
It's hard on the handler. It's a hard sport. Yeah. I mean, they're all hard. They're all challenging in any sport that you do regularly that, you know, anything that's pointed and judged by somebody else by a standard really tests your training chops, you know, and people, you know, a lot of companion dogs trainers say, this isn't real or it's not applicable, but it really does help you hone your skills and make you clear in your communication and makes you very aware of what you're doing. So to go back to this, it's not a stylized heel. A dog should not, in the healing part of the obedience, the dog should not forage or separate, you know, drifting around a corner and looking out at, you know, something at the, you know, on the side. We had chickens on our field, so.
Yeah, lollygagging is the term we use in the Hoopers.
Oh, there you go.
Lollygagging and look where you're meant to be looking.
I like that. And yeah, you know, they're like, you know, we have these chickens that come onto our field all the time. It's annoying, but it's also a great training opportunity. And, you know, and heel, you don't want the dog turning and saying, well, what's that chicken doing over there? So, it does matter in that sense, but really it is. I find it's just hard on the handler in a way that I think is helpful, because if you're not being consistent in your cues, and this goes for all training, your dog is going to fail in some way, you know, or falter. And that is not the dog's fault. That is on you. And so you become very aware of your body language, because these things are competitive. Yes. Secondary cues are definitely pointed, you know, or deductions, right?
Oh, so, okay.
So did you give an extra command? Did you, which means you maybe trained off the field doing something else to cheat, quote unquote, cheat, right? So everybody has to be fair and clear in doing the same thing. So you can't say anything but the accepted cues. You must say the dog's name, because if you only say the dog's name half the time, maybe when you don't say the name, it means something different to the dog, you know, or maybe if you say their full name versus their nickname, it's a different cue. And now you're cheating and giving a double command. Have you scratched your head? Are you, do you pick up your whistle when the dog can see you? That's a cue, you know? Yeah. So you become really, really hyper aware of your handling and the clarity that it takes to be fair and consistent. So right there and then, I think every handler, every companion dog trainer right there and then can learn tons about how to be consistent. And we all know these things. It's not that this isn't new information to a professional trainer. You have to be consistent and clear, but in practice, and when somebody else is judging you to a standard, you realize, wow, I am very casual every time I, you know, call my dog, or I always put my hands on my hips, or I always stick my hand in my pocket for the treat, whatever it may be, you know.
Yep.
You cannot do any of those things. You know, you would be, you know, lambasted if you put your hand in a pocket when you did the when you called the recall. You can't do that, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's a test, you know. It is a test of the dog's courage and temperament and abilities and physical structure, but it's also a test of the handler. And that's where I have found tremendous value for me, you know, aside from, we talked about the relationships, mm-hmm. the end of it with the dog, but I mean I've been doing dog training professionally for literally 30 years now, and I started in dog sports. I dabbled when I had my American Bulldog about 18 years ago, but we didn't stick with it for various reasons, which is a whole nother topic, which I'm happy to talk about, but not right now. But got into bike sports more. And when I first learned dog training, I also kind of dabbled back then and did some tracking and some IGP style stuff, mm-hmm. but just dabbling and learning about it, and didn't go on and practice that at the beginning of my career. So I'd say I was about 15, 20 years into my career when I really started doing sport work comfortably. Not comfortably. It wasn't comfortable at all.
You mean. Yes, you've transitioned.
Well, I mean, I started actively doing it. Yeah. And, you know, to be 20 years into your career and feel like a newbie and also to find something that can pique my interest and challenge me was huge and game changing in a way that I would encourage everybody to try. And I would not encourage them to wait 20 years because if I had known then what I know now, I would have done this 20 years earlier, because the education is immense, and you're not going to find that level of education elsewhere. And it doesn't have to be a bite sport, although I would also recommend that, not that you have to participate, but definitely going and learning, mm-hmm. and watching and having an open mind and asking questions and learning about how to work with dogs when they're at a certain arousal level, and to not always be afraid of that. In the companion dog world, we're always tamping everything down and turning everything off, and almost every client says, how do I get my dog to stop doing this? How do I get this to stop? And there's very little emphasis put on how do I just channel that and again allow them to express what they're doing. And people are afraid of dog behavior. And this again goes back to, you know, you got the beast, then what the heck are you doing with them now? You know, you don't want them to do any of the things that they do. And I'm gonna include trainers, most trainers, mm-hmm. In companion dog training are afraid of behavior. And I don't mean, oh, you're afraid of aggressive dogs. I mean, not that one is afraid of aggressive dogs, but it's like, oh, go, don't let them practice that. Oh, never let them do that. Oh, don't, they're getting excited. You know,
I had that a lot with my ball breed girl. It was like, oh God, no, we can't let her go. And actually I stopped doing a lot of sports stuff with her because she just got too over aroused. And it was like, so do we work through the arousal or do we just stop doing the activity? And actually I stopped doing some of the activities and I found ones that were, I felt more suitable for her. I mean, I've never known a dog squeal at the start of a track. Like you take her up to the tracking pole and she'd literally be squealing. And I was like, this for her right now is enough arousal.
They squeal, they get excited, they get, and I'm not advocating for letting a dog go into over arousal or just be, you know, yes, crazy and willy nilly out there. But the beauty is in the sports, you learn how to harness these things, mm-hmm, put them on stimulus control, and you don't need to be afraid of these things happening. You just have to provide appropriate outlets and scale up gradually.
Yeah.
Or harness from the beginning. And I think that there's not a dog trainer out there that won't benefit from learning about that, whether or not they utilize that very often in their repertoire of, you know, of protocols, because a lot of problems can be resolved by literally providing an appropriate outlet, literally by, you know, and an appropriate outlet is not going to be a chew toy or a lick mat, or, you know, yeah. I mean, these don't blow off steam in the right way for some of these dogs. And they are a little, they're pressure cookers that have, you know, that don't have an appropriate valve, you know, I mean, you can't, yeah, just let a little bit seep out here and there because the pressure is still going to build over time. And then you're, you know, you're never meeting the beast. I love to say that, you know, meet the beast where they are. Yep. I love a dog that gives me a lot. And then you can shape that. It's like having a giant mound of clay that you can now not only mold into a beautiful sculpture, although, you know, but you could also, you can make a village. You can make many sculptures. You can, you because you have so much to work with and you can, yeah, put that in different categories. Whereas, you know, if you just try to
suppress it,
pound it down, like you still have this giant lump of clay that's sitting there. You know, I don't know. Maybe that's a bad analogy.
No, that's a good analogy. No, I like it because I, you know, I feel that for me and Dodge, like Hooper's is our thing. It's what his temperament and physicality allows us to do partly, but also it taps into that droving of being a shepherd and him working away from me and listening to me from a distance and having to, you know, stay on the line, but also listen to me at the same time, which doesn't always happen. It also helps if I remember the correct cue at the correct time, because that's always fun in the middle of a competition, isn't it? Where I say something and I'm like, shit, that was the wrong cue. Yep. And sometimes I can hear the eye roll of him going, she didn't mean that one. I'm going to just proceed forwards with what I was doing because she's not qualified today.
She's not qualified. We're always the ball and chain, aren't we? We screwed up so many.
Right? Like, I'm sure that half the time you just hear the eye rolls of the dogs going, oh God, she forgot the cue again. Like,
but then, you know, you're in a high pressure situation. You're having to think fast. And we all have nerves around these things because, yeah, we're performing. I mean, even as you get used to it, you know, you're in a different zone. And that's something to practice too. You know, being stressed out or nervous about something or being really amped up about it yourself. Like, this is how our clients feel when they're, mm-hmm, at the park. And they're scared and they're learning something new. And they're, maybe they have some emotional baggage around the fact that their dog is, you know, barking and lunging at something and they're going to give the wrong cue. And so it's also, it's a nice bit of empathy, you know, because we don't, you know, we get really good at managing and training in our native habitat, which is, you know, parks and backyards and on streets, you know, and stuff. And we don't have the nerves and we have the clarity. Whereas when you put the stakes higher and your dog is up in drive and doing the thing they love to do, the stakes are higher and we often, yeah, get a little weirder. And I think our clients honestly feel like that just in our lessons, in our sessions.
Yeah, of course.
So gives us a bit of empathy and puts us in a more compassionate mindset. And also then it will give us tools, as we learn to work through these things in the sports, we're also we are learning tools that we can then pass on to our clients in a more empathetic way. And I don't mean that, I don't mean empathetic way in like you're not yelling at your client. I mean more like, wow, I really know how that feels because I gave the wrong cue, which I did do. That's how I lost 30 points. You know, you have to say the dog's name and then the cue. And I did initially, but then when he didn't do the thing he was supposed to do, I didn't repeat it exactly the same way. I just said, you know, I just said the cue, and because I was now in a heightened state, you know.
But
and,
it's not a mistake if you learn from it. It's a lesson. Yeah,
exactly. And then what do you learn? And what did I learn? And then how can I help my regular clients utilize that same tool, that same skill? Like, what did I have to practice? What drills did I have to do? What mindset did I have to be in so that I could perform better for my dog next time? And that is absolutely relevant in our day-to-day work, you know. And we forget what it's like to be a novice or to have that level of adrenaline or concern or excitement when you're out in the world with the way that our clients often do, you know.
And also I think it's easy to kind of forget that we have the muscle memory of how to deliver a treat in a certain way, or how reward placement helps the dog, or even how, like, you know, specific marker cues can help with arousal levels and stuff. And this is why I think as well, like, sport in general is, I mean, my goal is that in 5 years' time, people will not be teaching hoopers bad, will be teaching hoopers properly and not be teaching agility badly. That's what my goal is, because I feel that hoopers for pet dogs, for companion dogs, is a much more inclusive sport, and it's something that kind of all dogs can have a go at without having too much pressure. Whereas when you start adding like some of the agility equipment in, some dogs just aren't physically fit enough to be able to do these things. Whereas if you're just getting them to move away from you, and people are like, oh, but you have to distance handle. I'm like, but distance is a perspective, because a 3 meter distance for Dodge is like a stride and a bit. A 3 meter distance for Minx, my Chihuahua, is a really long way.
Yeah, it is.
So I think that definitely like getting more trainers into doing a bit of sports stuff is good, because it gets your juices flowing, doesn't it? As a trainer, it kind of teaches you different mechanics and tests your ability, not just, you know, the kind of obedience. And when I say obedience, I mean the stuff that kind of Joe blogs public on the street would like their dog to not pull on the lead, would like their dog to sit when they ask them, would like
general
their
dog to
chill out when they're in a bar. Like, I mean, like that little bit more kind of fancier heel work, that little bit of distance work, whether it's a send away or, you know, handling a sequence of hoops from 20 meters away or whatever it is, you know, just, I feel sometimes we get kind of bogged down in teaching the stuff that the people want to learn, and we forget that we can teach our dogs new stuff too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think our dogs' lives can, you know, as trainers, our dog lives, if we're not doing something proactively with them that's structured and sport-like, many of them, their lives get smaller. That's what they are, the shoemaker's children.
Right.
Degree as well. So this is also a way to keep yourself honest and motivated to work. And I love new sports that are bringing elements of sport training to the average person. I mean, you know, we've seen over the past 20 years or so, you know, scent work come to pet dogs, and hoopers is a similar thing. Not that it's like scent work, but that it's, you know, it's making something accessible.
Yes.
But it's not that it's easy, but it's more available and
it's more accessible for people at home, right? Like scent work, you have your odor and you can set up hides like in your backyard, in your kitchen. I mean, God, when Dodge was a puppy, I'd find random bits of Kong all over the house that like I'd forgotten to pick up. And all of a sudden he'd like be walking around and suddenly indicate. And I'd be like, oh, I'm really sorry, dude. Like, I did not mean to leave that there.
I leave that there.
Because I'm a bad dog parent, obviously. But hoopers is the same, you know, like you can literally have a hoop in your front room and, You can just sit on the sofa and just have the dog going backwards and forwards through the hoop while you're reinforcing them. Like, that's the foundation of it.
And it's structural. It's structured. Like, it's structural. It's structured. It's like, it's not just, I mean, don't get me wrong. Scatter feeding is, you know, has its place, and mat snuffle mat feeding, and like mats and Kongs and chew toys and puzzle games. They utilize all of these things, but it's not the only thing you can do. So setting up a hoop or two cones or mm-hmm. or hiding a bit of Kong or, you know, or a toy in the house, these things have a little more structure to them, which I think for the dogs give them this active job to do. It's not mm-hmm. just always a passive activity, like chewing a bone. Like chewing a bone is a great thing for a dog to do. It's an outlet. It definitely will calm them down. It gives them a workout, but it's not the same thing as saying, I did the thing today, you yeah. know? And dogs need challenges. Everybody needs a purpose and a challenge yeah. in life. Otherwise you get depressed or lethargic, let's say yes. lazy. And I think a lot of our dogs are living like that. And then for some dogs, it just ends up with a low level depression. And I don't even mean clinically necessarily, although you could argue that too. You know, where life is just kind of the same every day, you know, versus, you know, and for other dogs, it actually becomes a problem. This is where mm-hmm. I think the dogs without outlets, some of them are getting low level depressed and some are getting agitated and frustrated, you know, and then finding their own games and their own. Again, this is going to come out for most, if a dog has some drive and oomph to them, this has got to come out somewhere.
Yep.
So, you know, it either can make a dog go too low or it can make them go too high if they don't have an outlet. Whereas we can just hit that middle sweet spot if we just actively do something, and it doesn't have to be hard. Now, I would argue if you get a dog, you signed up to have to do something with them that takes a little time out of your day on the regular, even if it's not every day.
And not talking about going to the park and using fucking ball chuckers. I'm assuming you don't get them so much over in the States. This is like a trend over here.
Oh,
we have the ball with the stick.
Oh, it's huge here. It's huge. And it
drives me insane. I'm like...
This is something that is another opportunity for trainers to really educate people. I mean... You know, on the one hand, people think they're exercising their dog, right? And so I think a lot of people who do this are at least dedicated to getting their dogs out regularly. And they probably don't realize that they might just be training in some over arousal and or repetitive kind of OCD type behaviors in their dogs, let alone the physical injury that can happen. We should tell them, right? From a trainer's point of view, it's not the best outlet, at least not as the be all end all. Like, of course, playing fetch here and there or teaching a retrieve. Well, teaching retrieve is very different than playing fetch with a chuck it.
Yeah.
But to me, when you're playing with a chuck it and you're still on your phone or on your earbuds, talking to somebody, you're still checked out. This is kind of phoning it in. Mm-hmm. It's not very creative, and it can be just, that can become drudgery for a dog, but it can also become addictive drudgery. You know, they need yeah. that hit. They need that dopamine hit that comes from these things. And it's this high that they get for being super, super active, yet kind of unengaged, or, you know, because it doesn't really take anything from the owner, especially for not adding any kind of obedience.
It's not a team sport, is it?
No, and there you become literally like one of those, you may as well get the automatic ball chuckers, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it you're just a part of the machine. So it's, now, you know, if I am going to play fetch with my dog, which I don't do a ton of because it is pretty overly exciting for them, but also it's just physically dangerous. I'm especially going to throw as poorly as I do, but you know, and the bouncier, the ball, the worse it is. Yeah. But if I am going to do this, I am going to interact and use it as a reward. And I don't have to, it's not about how far and how hard can I throw it. It's about, I wouldn't do very well in that department anyway, but it's more about just the toss. I can toss the ball in the air 3 feet in front of me and, you know, just a, you know, 6 feet in the air, 3 feet in front of me, and the dog is happy because it's the catching, it's the getting it, and yes. maybe that is a reward for doing something interactive with me, or for what they're not doing. You know, if there's a dog coming down the path and they look at the dog and they pause, I might mark for, hey, catch, come catch. You know, and
it's
so
one of my markers for Dodge is catch. It's one of the ways I also proofed our start line weights, because then I could throw things towards his head so he didn't have to move.
Yes, exactly. And so it's not that you never throw a ball again, it's that you do so mindfully and you change the focus. And you know, there isn't much use for just chucking a ball or sending your dog into a park and kind of letting them off and then half checking out. Be mindful. It doesn't take as much time as you think. You can tire a dog out more productively, meaning you're not just training an athlete, an adrenaline junkie, if you, like you would be with a ball. You can do, you know, 10 minutes of working and small ball tosses, you know, training, mm-hmm. training quick down, training to look at that other dog and then look back at you and then throw the ball or do a little circle around you and come to heel and then lie down. And 10 minutes of training with toys in a, you know, all within, you know, just a little, I don't know, you know, 3 meter range around you is going to be more valuable to your dog's mental and physical health than throwing a ball with a chuck hit device for half an hour. You don't need to do as much as you think if it's mindful and thoughtful and you're working their brain as much as their body. It keeps them in a better state of mind too. And then, you know, a good swim or a long walk with you after training or before training. I like to do it after, you know, personally. Yeah. I like all the energy up front. And then, of course, we do also sprinkle a little bit of training, even just a quick cue here and there while we're doing our fun, relaxing time activities. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. And then they can sniff and range. But they've also, that itch has been scratched, that mm-hmm. that pressure valve has been relieved, and now they can just be with you on a walk.
Yeah.
You know, they can sniff and range. And we end our training with some sort of loose activity.
Yeah,
almost all of the time, versus the loose activity or a high amped play activity that doesn't really involve me being the thing. I don't take my dogs to the park or a trail and just let them off leash and go have at it. You know, we do things and then we walk together and maybe they'll get a little swim or maybe I'll toss the log into the water for a few minutes right there, and water fetch is so much better for them. But it can't be the be all end all, but people don't know this. Again, let's use social media for good. Let's explain why we're doing what we do, and it can become the norm. You know, like just like, I don't know if it is as big of a deal in the UK as it was here, and certainly dating myself by saying this, but you know, when I was a kid, nobody wore seatbelts in the car.
I can remember like my child seat, my booster seat was literally like a piece of foam that was kind of shoved on the seat. And then
it was just so you could see out the window and nothing to do with seat.
I can remember being the back of my dad's car. My dad had a sport car and the back seats used to fold down. And I would be sat next to the collie in the back with absolutely no seatbelts on. Yeah, not even in a seat, like literally just. And I learned how to lean by watching the bloody dog.
Yep. So that's the thing. I mean, but now that is not a thing, right? It became standard practice with some education and some and marketing and I guess some legislation too. Mm-hmm. Initially, buy-in is not always easy for change. So sometimes legislation can be helpful, although I'm careful when I say that, because over legislation done by people who don't know what they're talking about is
especially when it comes to our dogs,
generally not a good thing.
Because you know the bullshit law we have in this country, so.
Yeah, and the political persuasions. But, you know, in general, the idea with the seatbelt thing was, how long did it take to change culture? It didn't take that long. I mean, kids that were born 10 years ago, 20 years ago, never experienced what we did. It was already just not a thing. So why can't we do that with dogs and just say, everybody who has a dog, just like everybody who gets in the car generally puts on their seatbelt, everybody who has a dog understands that they also have to choose an activity now that is a productive activity that they do with their dog. And it's just a matter of course, you know, and it isn't just walking or playing with ball. Walking is one of the best things you can do with your dog on the regular, obviously. And if you do little check-ins here and there, and you know, it can be more relational depending on how you're doing it. But anyway, I think we can change this. And I think we have to normalize activities and not villainize activities. Also not make them so challenging or gatekeepy. Every sport should have an entry level that is accessible to all. And some sports might just stay accessible to all. And there's so many ways to encourage people with achievements and real achievements. I don't mean participation awards, but hey, like you showed up today and your dog, you know, improved. You know, I like the most improved award. Yeah. It doesn't matter what the end goal is in some of these sports. You did it. You showed up, you did it. Your dog couldn't pay attention to you for 2 seconds before, and now look at them. Now you've done a routine, and maybe your heel wasn't perfect, and maybe it wasn't prancy, but your dog heeled next to you in a happy, relaxed way for 10 steps. That is most improved, and that might, you know, like, and that encourages people because they also need the reinforcement, and they don't need to feel bullied or intimidated when they go into something new, not knowing what they're doing.
I mean, I know from a judging point of view, I have given judges specials to people that have, I remember there was one dog that she was halfway round her like go, her turn. And I think it was a bird scare or something. And I just watched this dog go, oh my God, I can't. And straight away the owner went, it's okay, come here. And I was like, okay, so you've just forfeited your whole run. And you've done what's right for your dog. So I'm giving you a judge's award for that because you put your dog's well-being above everything.
Yeah.
I will lead to in a minute because I think that's one of the other things that kind of is a misconception. And I know that from an outsider looking in, and again, especially because of social media and people putting stupid videos on TikTok and whatever other platforms they're using, that it's sport first, dog second. And that is not the bloody truth.
I mean, yes, overwhelmingly, that is not the truth. And the people are doing this. I mean, you have people that are, you know, podium chasers and award chasers for sure.
Oh, I'm a ribbon whore. I'm a fully, like, I will hold my hands up and say I'm a ribbon whore and I love getting prizes. But example this weekend, Dodge had, and it was a minor little slip, it was nothing major, but he had a little slip of coming out of a tunnel before a barrel, and he just went, oh, I'm not sure. And I was like, do you need a cuddle? And he was like, yeah, I do. And he ended up on his back and we had a little belly rub, and I know the judge anyway, and I was like, can I try again? And she was like, yeah, of course. Obviously I'd forfeited my run, but I sent him out again and he was like, I'm not really feeling it. And I was like, that's cool, bud. We'll just have a little game and we'll leave the ring and we'll come back. The next run, he was much better.
It's meant to be fun for them, and taking those moments and taking those forfeitures, is that the word? Would you say that? You know, and doing those things really will enhance your relationship and the trust that then will allow them to push through even further. And I do want to talk about resilience and how that comes into play at some point as well.
I will make a note of that.
But it is relational. It is relational. And this goes back to the teamwork. You know, if your dog is your teammate, you do what you need to do in the moment. And, you know, there's always tomorrow or another competition, or ultimately at the end of the day, you're taking your dog home. And that is the important bit. So there is, I think, the idea that these dogs are quote unquote abused because they're forced to do these things is a misguided perception. I mean, never say never. I'm sure there are some people out there that are not always thinking of the dog's best interest, but you get that in just a regular walk. You know, you get that in every home. That's a personal problem. And that's not the problem of most of these sports. The dogs are doing what they want to do. do they have to work through some adversity sometimes? in order, which will go right into resilience.
Yeah.
Yes, they do. Can that be done in a way that is supportive and leaves the dog feeling more confident and successful? You know, absolutely. You know, sometimes a challenge and meeting your dog at a challenge and supporting them through that, whether it is taking a break or pushing, and you do have to learn when, like, no, you got this, like giving them a moment to problem solve, like in scent work, let's take it out of physicality for a minute and not stepping in and saying, well, you can do this, or it gives, I mean, they feel, I'm sure they feel achievements, you know, and, you know, they're meant to problem solve. Everything with a brainstem, you know, is meant to problem solve and get through the day. And if you take away that work, quote unquote work, that reason for being, I think again, you get depressed animals, you get fragile animals, and this goes for the human animal as well.
Yeah.
Think about the moments that make you most proud as a person, you know, it's very often persevering through a little bit of hardship, not that doesn't mean it has to be painful or abusive.
No, I come from horse background, so I understand that, like, you know, sometimes you would fall off or you'd try and get over a jump or you might not be able to, and you just had to get on and try again. And I'm kind of grateful for having that background that I have, of that, you know, come on, like, it doesn't always work, and you'd get used to riding one horse and then they'd be like, okay, now you need to ride this horse, and you'd be like, what? And that's another thing that I find, is that it's good to handle other dogs in your sport, even if it's just at a training level. I think that helps us as handlers, but also I think it can help us unlock some of the magic code in our own dogs when we've worked with a different dog.
Oh for sure. Because you're looking at the problem from a different angle and you have to problem solve differently, and maybe you become more aware again of your own handling cues. It's, you know, so getting out there, and I'm a big advocate for handling other various dogs. I love to do fostering, and I recommend everybody do fostering for that reason as well. Get out of your comfort zone, maybe even try a breed that you're not used to, and realize that, you know, there are differences. So absolutely. And then, you know, going back to the resilience, the perceived cruelty of making a dog do something. You know, I can't stop this girl behind me from doing something. You can't see this on the podcast, but it's kind
the visual for
joke.
The listeners, the current view I have is there is a bed in the background of Kelly Scream with a Malinois fast asleep having a lovely time.
Yeah, it's kind of funny if you could see it.
She is stunning as well.
You can't stop her from doing anything, but here she is snoozing away. Holding them back from challenges is cruel. You know, they need to problem solve. They need to feel self-confidence.
Yes.
You know, and so, you know, whether it's walking over a little teeter, you know, a low teeter for a puppy, or a wobble board, or learning how to, right now she and I, she's injured. And so we're doing things that are really hard, but not fun. That's what I call them, which is rehab. And so it's funny.
I remember teaching Munchkin, my bull breed. She could do, I think it was 5 different face targets of various facial parts, because she had a paw injury. And like the only bit that was meant to be moving was kind of her head, because she was meant to be resting her foot. So
how creative of you, though.
Like her chin and the end of her nose and the top of her nose, and then both cheeks and the top of her head.
And just something to do. Something to do while you've got your downtime. They don't have video games, you know?
Yes.
But I have to say, she doesn't like her rehab, I can tell, because it's hard and not quote unquote fun. So is that cruel? You know, like we're doing, if you watched me do a rehab session, not you, but one of you out there, and you'd say, oh, look at that. That's great. She's, you know, it's how thoughtful an owner to take her to rehab and do these things. And that's, you know, maybe that's true, but then you might watch me doing the palisade with her, where it's a bit of a struggle to climb over. That's the giant wall that they have to go.
How high is it? 6 foot?
Oh gosh, no, that's the way over 6 feet. At the lowest, it's at least 7 feet, and then it goes up from there.
Wow, so it's like a puissance.
It's a scramble.
Boston, I mean, they're not that's jumping like it. A big old wall. Okay.
Oh yeah, it's a scramble. Like they're running and climbing it basically, right? If they can get their paws to the top.
But they are trained to do this, and you don't stick it straight up at 7 foot, right?
There's a lot of different ways you can do this. You can do it with like an A-frame that gets gradually higher, or you can do it just really low. It's actually one of the easier things for them to do. That's the other thing. People perceive this as something cruel. It's a Malinois. And not just a Malinois. There are other dogs that can do this too. It's not that challenging for them.
Oh, there's a reason why Dodge has not been taught to go over things.
Right.
Oh, I have a 6 foot fence. So yes. There's a reason I haven't encouraged this.
And really the Palisade isn't a jump. It's a scramble, right? But people might say that's cruel. Well, she loves it. And the physicality of getting in there and slamming into it and scrambling and achieving is way more fun for her, I promise, than it is to do one of our exercises that she's finding challenging. We're putting her on a plank, like a kato board, a plank that's the skinny kind, not a wide like square or rectangle, more of a really long plank, and she's got to keep her body in a perfect position. Her feet in a perfect position without shifting her weight while she goes from a down to a stand, for instance.
Wow.
So she's using her muscles in a certain way, or we're on an incline, the rear in the air a little bit while we're doing the same thing, working her quads. Or a sit. She knows how to sit, obviously, and she can sit. She has to sit at the edge of the board so her tail is off, so that the spinal alignment is better than if she had her tail bent, where her rear is. Mm-hmm. And she has to stay at the edge. So that's already precision work. She can't shift and scoot forward because at that point she's not very close to me, right? Because the board is in the way at the front of the board. So she's got to stay at the edge. And then I do a little nose pop up to my hand and she's got to pop forward. This isn't sit pretty. This isn't a jump. It's not just a static nose touch where she's just stretching her spine. She's got to pop forward. So she's using her, certain muscles in a certain way. And she finds it so, so challenging. And it's so much harder to her, hard but not fun. She's getting rewarded.
Yeah.
And she's learning to do a new thing. And I think that might be rewarding to a certain degree, because if I release her from the board, she will absolutely get back on the board on her own and say, okay, I'm ready for another go. But, why do people not see that as cruel? It's me making my dog do something.
Yeah.
Naturally, whereas with the walls, like that is actually more natural. I didn't have to teach her to climb things or want to jump on top of things, or I had an American bulldog that loved to slam into things. You don't get to
such a bad thing,
you know, like oh my gosh, it was ridiculous. So teaching him to jump over, he was actually quite athletic, but teaching him to jump over things took a minute because he was like, oh, hey, Kool-Aid, like I can smash into it and it's even more fun, like it crashes then, let's check this out, and he would just go through it like, oh my gosh, and he loved that.
I mean, we always joked, don't we, that bull breeds will attack
crash and slam
direct route, which is through, regardless of what is in the
paper hoop. We put the hoop with the paper so they could rip through it every time, like a circus animal. He would, the teeter was also challenging for him, not because he didn't like the movement, but because he very quickly also learned that, you could climb up the end that's on the ground, or you could just jump onto the other end and it slams down, and he would choose that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, no, and he's like, but check this out again. Look, I can make it slam. I can make it crash. So for him, agility was challenging in a different way, but you don't get to choose what they love. And bulldogs love tactile, slammy, crashy.
Reinforcing. And this is the other thing, isn't it? Because, I am mindful how I say this, but as much as the dog chooses the reinforcement, the dog also chooses what's aversive to them.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. We don't get to choose. And some things back to the bulldog. I would play soccer games, football games with him and such. And sometimes I'd miss. I'm not the most athletic person, and I'd kick him in the head. And, you know, he didn't even notice. I mean, the only problem was I'd break my toes, you know, in that big fat head. And he would be none the wiser or think that was part of the game if I was, you know, if he did feel it. And, yeah. You know, I couldn't smack that dog hard enough for fun. You know, he loved the tactile,
roughhousing and yeah,
an empty bottle, water bottle, and hitting him. Oh, she loves that too.
Uh-oh, and that just woke the Malinois up.
And there's smacking games. Smacking games are the best. I know. So, you know, that's it, physically punishing him. Not that I am inclined that way. Would have been really hard, you know, with his thick neck and his thick head and his muscle-bound body that loved all that stuff. It was way more aversive to him. And, you know, it was sad at the time, but it's actually kind of funny too. If I sighed, his world crumbled, and he would just become like Eeyore, you know, woe is me, the world is so awful. And so for him, I did try agility with him, as I was explaining, mm-hmm. with his slammy style. It was
slammy, you know, fat head bulldozing it.
Oh, it was ridiculous. It was, the comedy was rich. But he didn't, so for him, weave balls. He didn't understand that. He's not a border collie.
But also the physicality of him doing weave paws must have been really hard, right?
He didn't. It was the concept of, yes, I think physically. I mean, he wasn't afraid of the poles and he would just as soon bend them.
They're not built to bend.
No, not really bendy. But so what we would do is, you know, we'd only put a few out, right? You know, as we progressed, and he would miss one. And then I've changed things up now, but at that point I wouldn't even do a mistake marker. We would just reset. Mm-hmm. He would find this devastating, you know, if there was a lack of a reward or a reset, he would just, you know, crumble. Whereas, you know, I could have, again, I didn't, I could have physically corrected him and he'd have been okay with that. But like, okay, that's clear. I have to do it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I just started him over, he fell apart. He's like, I must have failed. Or if I sighed about something else, if I looked at my phone inside, you know, somebody forgot to close the door, he'd be like, oh, why is she upset? Did I do something?
Yeah.
So the funny thing is I did learn how to, so repeating without reward or not giving him, a mistake marker was actually really, really upsetting to him. He needed more information and clarity and would actually prefer it. So think about what you're doing with each animal and what they prefer. The hot and cold game with just hot or cold is really, really hard and demotivating. You want to give input on both sides so they know, so they're not making the same mistake or worse mistakes and getting more off track every time. But we would lift him up. He loved to be sprayed with like scent. So like I would bring a lavender spray and to, you know, this big tough bulldog with his big inscrutable expression, and he'd get kind of downtrodden about not understanding something, and I could just take him off the path for a minute, off the equipment, and play a spray game, you know, and like I'd spray him with his, it could be almost anything, you know, but and he would go crazy and run and get really happy. It was really cute.
But it's really interesting you said about the sigh, because that's one of the things that works with Dodge. Like if I'm like, well, you like, there's no point me getting mad with him because he's like, oh well, whatever. Whereas if I go, he goes, oh no, was I not?
Yeah.
And it's so interesting, like, because from the outside perception, that little is nothing, but in his little world, like, he's just opened his eye, like, why is she doing the noise? Like, yeah. I'm just laying here being good. You are a good puppy dog and you're fine, it's okay. But it's so interesting that the perception, and we are not saying that it's okay to hit dogs or be a dick to dogs, like, no, don't do that. But we also need to understand that some dogs like roughhousing and like a bit of doofing. I mean,
and like sport. It's not torture. You know,
one of the games that Dodge plays with my husband, not with me, because I'm not dealing with that because it involves teeth on skin and stuff, but they wrestle each other. And literally the cue for it from my hubby is, oh, I'm going to get him. I'm going to beat him. I'm going to beat him up. And George thinks that's like the best game ever because him and Daddy get to roughhouse and he gets to leave on skin and wrestle and do all that stupid stuff. Whereas I don't partake in that because it's a 35 kilo shepherd and it hurts. So
So your one's perception does not make for reality. You do have to look at the dog in front of you and what they were designed to do and how they're expressing themselves. So these dogs are not just tools for most people out there. They are absolutely enjoying what they're doing. They like the challenges. They have been trained incrementally. They get massive rewards often after doing it, but honestly the thing is rewarding in and of itself. It's more about you have to become more rewarding as a trainer, not because you're doing something that is so awful for them to have to do, but because you need to find a way to become anywhere near as reinforcing as the thing you're asking them to do.
Yes.
Because boy, that's an eye opener. You know, when they love, if they do love jumping, if they do love, the biting and the chasing, or if they do want to do the retrieving, and you are now, yes, you're their access to it, but sometimes like in a French ring trial at level 3, you are on the field for about 40 minutes.
Wow.
And yes, you can take a water break if your dog needs a water break, but that's it. And you have, your dog is naked. They only wear a muzzle for the muzzle heel, and they only wear a collar and leash for the heel and leash. Nothing on the dog and nothing on you. You are not naked, thankfully. But you have nothing but your recall. You can either use your voice or a whistle. You have your retrieve item in your pocket, which can be, I think they just changed the rules, it can only be a sock, but it could be a sock or gloves or an eyeglass case. You have no toys, you have no food, you have nothing. You have a training vest, which is a nice cue that you're training. Apologies, there's a truck going by.
That's okay, that's fine. As long as it's not a dog and it's a truck, that's cool. But that I find that interesting, though, that the dog is basically naked, because that kind of, my brain then puzzles of why would people use more aversive tools to train the elements if the end goal is for the dog to be naked?
Well, it's a good question. First of all, just reiterate, the dog is naked for, at the lowest level, it's a 15-minute routine, then it's 20, then it's 30-ish, then it's 40.
That's so a long time, though, of naked.
So anybody who's doing this, any dog that's doing this, is a willing participant, I promise you. They can leave the field. Mm. They can leave the field. So there's that. So keep that in mind. And yes, when you're training, and I wouldn't even say, your question is a good one about equipment, but I would add to that, why would you use anything? I mean, you have to. You have to use reinforcements, and you have to use.
Of course, yes.
In training. I like to train as naturally as possible, meaning the dog is.
I meant like in terms of tools, like your.
Oh, no, I know, but I'm going to take it a step further and say, okay. Any tool, right? Like you have to fade whatever it is. So you have to be a good trainer. And the more that you're relying on anything, whether it's a harness, a head halter, a toy, a food, an e-collar, anything that you have to rely on is something you're going to have to fade. So the more that it is relational, and the more that you are just having fun with your dog. A lot of my training doesn't look like training. Uh-huh. I think a lot of my sessions are not very formalized, and I have a little bit of that on video. I probably will do some more. It's just me and the dog out front, and we sprinkle some stuff in, because you do have to fade anything you add. Yeah, you got to be a good trainer, and you got to know how to fade your prompts and your tools and your reinforcements. And you're not getting that if the dog doesn't want to do the thing, and you're not getting that if the dog isn't, a willing participant that loves working with you. Mm-hmm. Because nothing tests your relationship more than having your dog just completely out there with, and they know they're on the field. They know there's a decoy hiding in the tent. They know the routine, and the fact that they stay with you already is so brilliant. And if they don't, it's telling you something.
Yes.
And so if your dog is becoming quote unquote trial wise, that means you're not fading your equipment well. And equipment, I don't just mean e-collars or prong collars. I mean food, toys, whatever it may be that you're using.
Your treat pouch, whatever has become.
an
accidental cue sometimes, right?
And or the dog isn't enjoying this with you. You know, they have things that are more reinforcing to them, or there's too much pressure for them. So if that's happening, you've got to evaluate where you've gone wrong. There's a little bit of shade seeking behavior, and some dogs are sniffing. Sniffing is a displacement behavior. Shade seeking can also be a displacement behavior, although it also can be friggin' hot. These things are always like, you know, done on the Sahara. You know, I don't know why it's always hot at dog events, but it is.
Right. It's either that or it's like torrential rain and you're like, okay, can we have like somewhere in the middle? Would be great. That'd be nice. Yeah. A little bit of cloud cover, gentle breeze. Thanks.
So, you know, and there are people that I know that pull their dogs, you know, to go back to, you know, these poor dogs have to do it. No. Those moments where you say, like, you stop the run and you have a cuddle or a belly rub. We have people that say he's not feeling it today. It is too hot, or whatever it may be. People do pull their dogs from these things, but some of these dogs will work through that adversity the same way we are out there every weekend in this crazy weather, because we love doing it. It's worth it, but it's got to be worth it. And your dog doesn't lie. And so when you're practicing or testing, watch for those signs of, you know, sniffing is the biggest one.
Yeah.
Sniffing is a displacement behavior. I would say 8 times out of 10, you know, in a sport dog, right? You know, and it's a subtle sign that they don't really want to be there, or they're not comfortable with the environment that day. And if you're getting a lot of it, you might be putting on too much pressure too soon. Can you push the dog? Will they push through that to do the thing if they really love the thing? Sure, but it's something you have to take note of. So. The dogs generally love it, and the less that you rely on any kind of help, the better you're going to be on the field. And that goes back to relationship and sprinkling. One of my best tips for people would be to integrate training into everything that you do. And I don't mean every time, or that your dog always has to be training. I mean, just weave it into your life, into all of the things that you do for joy. Don't make training and play mutually exclusive, whether it's playing with people, play with other dogs. Don't make hikes and swims mutually exclusive with their training. And don't make your formal training mutually exclusive from your trip training. Integrate all of these things. So this dog just has this beautiful picture of doing all the things with you, and all of the rewards come from all of the things, because they're always woven together.
Yes.
And I think that's the biggest tip that I have, that you don't have to do formal training sessions all the time, and training sessions need not be long. Getting a rep or two in while you're doing anything that your dog enjoys and just being mindful when you're interacting with your dog and not checking out, and making sure that you are present mentally, not just physically, and that your dog realizes that your presence is also a part of doing the things that they love,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you're not unintentionally making dog play or fetch, you know, and throwing a ball, kind of mutually exclusive from connecting with you.
Yep.
Is probably the biggest tip that I can give.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important one, because I know for myself with Dodge, because I do have to be very selective of where he goes in the world because of his big emotions with certain things like life. When he's playing with his friends, you know, I will make sure that I still have a recall, that he can still, you know, go into a down if I ask him to or stuff, because there are certain things in life that, dude, I just need you to listen to me, and you can go back to play in a minute. But right now, this second, I need you to do this. And as long as he can go, oh, okay, yeah, I'll come back to you. I'm like, cool, go carry on playing again. He's like, so you just wanted me to do like that one down. I'm like, yeah, that's all I wanted. I just needed to know your ears were still on.
And think about it. In reality, when, you know, in real life, you don't need 20 repetitions of something. You need it once, but you need it quickly, efficiently, and willingly.
Yes.
And so just practicing in your daily routine makes that practice part of the part of the routine, and then when you need it, you've got it, and it's not a big deal, and it's not so different, it doesn't look different than the picture when you're training, because that in and of itself will make a dog less successful. If you never train in situ and then suddenly you bring your training into the situation, you know, the real life situation, and you've never integrated them before, you're going to have a problem. And that's not a dog, you know, blowing you off or flipping you off. It's a dog who's just not practiced and doesn't understand the concept.
And that's where I think as well, like, sport really does teach you about proofing and the dog understanding the concept of, oh, we're doing this exercise. Oh, but hang on, we're in a complete different environment today. And yes, it's, this is a quote of my husband now, a field full of middle-aged women, because that's generally where it is, right? But it's still going to be different. And it's just little things like what surface you're on, what the weather's doing. You know, we've said about heat and rain and stuff, but all of that stuff is going to affect the dog's performance. But also, if you have never trained something in, you know, this winter, we actually had a bit of snow in the UK, and straight away people were like, can we do hoopers in the snow? I was like, as long as your dogs aren't slipping, yeah. If it gets icy, no. But if it's just snow, then yeah, proof it. Why not? It's fun.
Yep. You got to look at all those, you know, inclement weather or the weird challenge that somebody is building next door, or there's suddenly you're in a field with a bunch of, you know, cows. Like, all these are opportunities for the smart trainer. It's, they're not hindrances. It's an opportunity.
Yeah. Okay. So guys, we are going to wrap up because I've taken a lot of Kelly's time this evening, or this morning for her. It has been an amazing episode, and I feel like I'm going to be cheeky and be like, can you come on again, please? Because I feel like we could talk about so much more sports stuff. Like, next season, can I pre-book you?
Oh, of course. This has been lovely. So fun. I love chatting with you. And
excellent. No, it has been amazing. So, Kelly, if people kind of want to know more, like, where can they find you on the socials, on websites, stuff like that? Where can they get more info?
I've got a few new things cooking that will be out shortly. And the best way to follow or find updates right now is either on Instagram at Kelly Dunbar Dog Training. Mm-hmm. And or just on Facebook at Kelly Gorman Dunbar is my page. Cool. And I will be making some announcements. There will be a new website. There's going to be a new program where I'm getting trainers together or people that are just training enthusiasts to kind of raise the bar, raise their game and get people out there doing things in a really comfortable and fun way so that everyone gets out and we get on this mission of doing more for the dogs and teaching owners how to do more with their dogs and bringing the sport world into the companion dog world in a really kind of organic and fun way.
So, excellent. That sounds amazing. So as always, guys, you know where you can find us on the socials at Canine Hoopers World, at Dodge Shepherd on the Insta. And until next time, stay safe, be kind, wash your hands thoroughly, keep your dogs on lead around livestock, and don't let them lick toads. Take care, guys. Bye. Guys, I just wanted to ask you a real quick favor. If you could rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast, it's going to help other people find me and listen to what I'm doing here at Canine Hoopers World. We're now on all the socials. So we have the Instagram, we have the Facebook, and we are officially on the TikTok at Canine Hoopers World. And remember to check out our website, www.caninehoopersworld.com, where you can find out information on in-person courses, online courses, and if you're doing hoopers with your dog, you can also join in with our online achievement awards. These are open to any person, any dog, anywhere in the world to come and test your skills and get yourself a cool ribbon.